Alright, so I'll explain the breakdown. Just to give a little bit of a framework of how I envision our Darabanan sojourn continuing and our story thus far. So our first part, all prompted by issues within Masechet Sukkah, beginning on our Daf Gimel, the question of how does rabbinic law affect Torah law when there is a contradiction, when there is what amounts to a revision, an enhancement of Torah law, how does that affect things? So all of that is an aspect that we discussed. We discussed the fact that there is a concept of Yesh Koach Laker Davar Min HaTorah B'Sheva Al Tasa, which has all kinds of fascinating implications. We only really pursued one. We mentioned that Rabbi Chanan has three interlocking chakiras. We focused on one of them. If there's time, I think maybe even tomorrow, I'd like to just revisit another one of them because it's all very fascinating. But we've been focusing on the question of, can a rabbinic law essentially rewrite a Torah law? Can we say that if the rabbis forbid us to do something like blowing shofar on Shabbos, taking a lulav on Shabbos, there's no mitzvah anymore? And on a different scale, if they tell us to make kiddush a certain way, to bench a certain way, does that mean that if we bench or make kiddush in a way that would have been satisfactory on a Torah level, it's no longer satisfactory? So we saw a lot of sources that address that, and we saw how the questions could be broken down into different parts. And it brings us to where we are today. So where we are today, and just to maybe map out what I'd like to talk about perhaps the rest of the week, is today I'd like to show how I think that question that we've been discussing really hinges on a basic fundamental understanding of how rabbinic law works within halacha. And so we're kind of working backwards, we're going to the core, and that's what today's Makor is mostly addressed. After that, time permitting, I'd like to revisit one of the issues of the Bahanin's Chakira, the question of Sheva Tasa, what role does it play, which has a lot of very cheerful lundas, as you might say. And then, because we're in Masechet Sukkah, I think also to consider the nature of the Gzeira, not to take a lulav on Shabbos, and that whole subtopic of Shema Yavirenu, what exactly did Chazal accomplish, what did they have in mind, etc., etc. I think that's how I see it playing out. Okay? So, reasonable. So today, let's start with this question. The question of how does last week's topic perhaps revolve around a basic understanding of rabbinic law. And what I'm about to say, I think, is actually very mukhrach. It really is pretty much glaringly true. Although I haven't seen so much in the Svarim that they've made this connection between last week's topic and this week's topic, but I think it's mamish, it's really very, very clearly there. It's kapta v'farach. It's really one goes in the other in a very clear way. So let me explain what I'm talking about. So the question of how exactly rabbinic law works. We mentioned at the outset, and you got to see a little bit, that there is a fundamental machlokas between the Rambam and the Ramban about what is the source for listening to rabbinic enactments. We have a pasuk in Parashat Shoftim, as we mentioned last week, Lo Sasu Min HaDavar, and we're not allowed to deviate from what the authority says. But one could have thought that that is simply judiciary authority, to use the terms of the U.S. government, that a judge has the binding authority to tell you what the existing legal code means. And so, too, that could have been what that pasuk is telling us, that whoever the rabbinic authority is at the time can tell you what the Torah means, and you are obligated to listen to them. The Rambam's Chiddush is that, and there are Gemaras that sound like it, there are Gemaras that sound like they support the Rambam, that it's not just judiciary authority, it's legislative authority as well. The idea of the rabbis can make up new law, say the Torah says this, but we also think you should do this, or we also think you should not do that, that also is included within the scope of los osim. And then we noted that if you take that position, that it's referring to a legislative concept rather than a judiciary concept, that helps us to understand what yomun is small means, that when Rashi tells you, even if right is left and left is right, and we ask, but that's not true, if they make a mistake, if they tell you something false, you're not supposed to listen. So if we're interpreting this verse only in a judiciary way, it's taka problematic. But if we interpret it in a legislative way, that the pasuk is saying, Chazal can make new laws, and they can even make new laws that contradict the Torah, knowingly, not as a mistake, but to knowingly contradict the Torah. So that could be, because we do have such a concept of what we've been discussing this past week, of Yesh Koach Laker Dover Min HaTorah B'Shei Baal Tasa. So that's the Rambam's view, that Los Osir includes both, and the Ramban disagrees. Okay, so far so good? So among the questions the Ramban has against the Rambam, yes sir?
So this is all rooted in the Rambam.
Yeah, in two places. Rambam talks about Hilchos Mamrim, and also in Sefer HaMitzvos, in the beginning of Sefer HaMitzvos, in the Shrashim. And that's where the Ramban is. The Ramban is in his commentary on the Sefer HaMitzvos. So Ramban says, there's a number of objections, but one of his objections, one of his broad objections, is, Rabbi Maimonides, I have a problem with what you're saying. We know that the Halacha distinguishes between Torah law and rabbinic law. It distinguishes in a number of ways. But most prominently, what's the most famous distinction between Torah law and rabbinic law? Safek, is that what he said? Right. Safek d'oraisa l'chumra, safek d'rabbanan l'kula. When we're not sure about how to apply Torah law, we have to be machmir, and if we're not sure about an issue of rabbinic law, so then we have the right to be maker. So ask the Ramban, Rabbi Maimonides, according to you, everything is Torah law. All of the rabbinic law comes from Los Osir. So what right do we have to distinguish? The obligation of Los Osir is telling me that I have to fulfill all these rabbinic details. How could you possibly distinguish between Torah law and rabbinic law according to you? So there are a number of approaches, just to give a little background on this, some of which you may have seen today. There are a number of approaches to defend the Rambam. We can break them down into a couple of schools. Now, one approach could say the first school, is to say like this. Say, Kach Tiknu. Yes, it's true that logically speaking, you're right. Leave things to their own devices, and rabbinic law should also have been lachumra. We should have said safek d'rabbanan lachumra too. But Chazal did this on purpose. And Chazal purposely said that when we make our laws, we are going to include within the rules, within the takana, that any safek should go lachumra. So by default, it would have been true. Safek d'oraisa l'chumra and safek d'rabbanan l'chumra also. Except that when the Chazal made up the rules, they made up this as well, that a safek is l'kula. So now, that breaks down itself into two possibilities. Why? Why did they do that? Why did they make their power less? Now, we should also just include, before I take any comment, that there is, in general, a machlokas harishonim. I'm sure you've all read the Sheikh Shemaisa several times. The line they say in Yeshivas is that since the author of the Shemaisa, the Ksosa Choshen, since the author of the Sheikh Shemaisa wrote it when he was 17, you could at least read it by the time you're 17. So I assume, therefore, you've all read it several times. Should point out that the Ksos, he must have revised it later on, because he quotes his son in the Shemaisa, so he may have been a tremendous Eloi. They can imagine how big an Eloi his son must have been if the father was 17. So, presumably he revised a little bit later. So, if you want to take a few extra months to get around to reading it, you can rely based on that. But one of the topics the Shmaisa talks about is that the whole concept of Safik d'oraisa l'chumra is itself a machlokas rishonim. That some rishonim maintain, without getting into tremendous detail about this, some rishonim maintain that that is a din d'rabbanim. The din of Safik d'oraisa l'chumra is a din d'rabbanim. We spoke about this a little bit in Parshas here a few weeks ago, if you recall. It came up. Bacharta b'chayim. We spoke about it in that pasuk. That the idea that one should be machmir in Torah law, maybe by Torah law itself there was no requirement. The Torah only addresses vados, only addresses definite situations. And the idea that we should be more machmir, maybe that itself is a din derabbanan. So if you say like that, then it's even better to say kach tiknu. That Chazal imposed the law of Safek l'chumra only on Torah law, and they didn't impose it on their own law. So then it works even more smoothly. Or you could say, no, that Safek d'oraisa l'chumra is a Torah principle, and it would have automatically kicked in when it comes to rabbinic law too, because of Lasasar, except that Chazal went out of their way to institute kulas in their laws. So now the question is, maybe we're going to comment on this. So why? Why would they make their laws more relaxed, so to speak, than Torah law? Well, so let's see first. Well, first we have to see why. Well, it helps understand the Rambam by itself, because the Rambam says, yeah, you're right. Because of Osasar, it should have been Safek L'chumra. But the rabbis exerted control over the situation. They made up rules that worked a different way, and they said that our rules are going to be Safek L'chumra. The question is, why would they do that? Oh, very good. So one, excellent, right? So you saw some, you saw the Rambam in Hilchos on today's Makoros, you saw some sources that indicated that way, right? That it could be they're concerned about Baal Tosef. It's an issue in general how to interpret what Baal Tosef asks of us. This is an issue that's not so clear. And we know we have a Torah prohibition of Baal Tosef, and what exactly it involves is a major discussion among the Rishonim. But it seems like it's a good question that if the rabbis could come and add new laws to the Torah, that sounds like Tosefi, right? That sounds Baal Tosefi. So is that really okay? If the Torah says, here's the Torah, no adding, but the rabbis can come and add, that's not a problem. So this is something which, as you can imagine, has been discussed throughout the centuries. And what the Rambam basically says in Hilchos Mamrim, we saw today, is that, well, it depends. Right? It all depends on how they phrase it. Which, if you think about it, is a very intuitive understanding of the concept. That clearly we're always going to have new things that we abide by as the generations go on. So maybe Baal Tosef, the whole question is, how is it being presented? Are we saying this is a part of what the Torah always was, even if it wasn't? Or are we acknowledging that it's something new? So the Rambam says that his go-to example is Oath V'Cholov, chicken cheeseburger. So let's say the rabbis have the right to prohibit chicken and milk, which was not included in the Torah prohibition of Basar V'Cholov. That's okay, the rabbis can expand it. But they can only do so if they acknowledge that it's a derabban, if they acknowledge that this is something new. If they were to pass it off as a din minat Torah, that would be a violation of Baal Tosef. And they tell a story that apparently in Europe, the question came to Reb Chaim Brisker at one point, that there was a certain town that had some type of a semi-famine going on, and it was approaching Pesach time, and all the food they had was, pretty much all, most of the food they had was kidneys. So it has to be, it's not all the food, but a good chunk of what they had to eat was kidneys. So the question was asked, should they observe the Ashkenazi minhag to abstain from kidneys that Pesach? And Reb Chaim's response was that not only are they not obligated to do that, to abstain in such circumstances, but it would be perhaps a prohibition to abstain from kidneys. Because to do so would be to treat this minig like a din d'oraisa, and it's crucial that we differentiate between dinim d'rabbanan and dinim d'oraisa.
Doesn't the Rambam equate minhagim to a level that
like, so even if we want to put it in the category of los aser, we still have to distinguish between d'rabbanan and d'oraisa minhagim, which is his point, right? That d'rabbanan he's putting in los aser, and yet then we have to still be clear of where it comes from. So according to this, the idea is, and this is how some of the Nosa Kalim on the Rambam comment explicitly also, that the idea is that we have to make a distinction between Torah law and rabbinic law, because if we don't, we risk violating Baal Tos. Now it's an interesting question, if this is so crucial, that we have to know the difference because of Baal Tosef. So has this been a successful plan over the generations? And so going both ways, so I see where you're coming from. Because from one perspective, it seems then troubling to note that there are so many dinim where we're not sure if they're d'oraisa or d'rabbanan. So if it's so crucial that we maintain the chiluk, so it seems like we haven't done a great job, because there are entire svarim, the Mabit, the Me'ara d'rabbanan, devoted to trying to figure out what's a din d'oraisa and what's a din d'rabbanan. And we know that there are machlokas all over the place in these issues. So that's a little unsettling if it's so important that we maintain the difference. But it's also something that we can appreciate when we learn at an advanced level. If you want to have pretty much any serious discussion of any halachic topic, now certainly in Hilchos Shabbos or in Hilchos Kashrus, really in any area, the first step always has to be clarifying whether the din is d'oraisa or d'rabbanan, because it's always got nafkaminas, it always affects the halacha tremendously. So on that level, we see how it plays out, that the halachic ramifications, the fact that the halacha distinguishes between d'oraisas and d'rabbanans, forces us to always keep our eye on that question of whether whatever we're talking about is d'oraisa or d'rabbanan. And if the Rambam says it's important to maintain the distinction because otherwise it's Baal Tosef, so then we see how the system works. Right? We see that these kulas built into the halacha force us to be aware of this, and being aware of it is important because otherwise it's Baal Tosef. So then that fits. So Chazal purposely said their din should be lakula, their dinim should be treated differently, because it was very important that they kept us aware of how their dinim were not on the same level as dinim and atar. Okay, so that's one approach you could take. Kach tiknu, because it is a concern about Tosef. That's one of the branches of school number one. Now, there's another approach you could take. And that is to say that Chazal set their dinim up this way because it was sufficient for their purposes. It wasn't necessary to be so machmir. Why? Why should that be? That whatever goal Chazal were trying to accomplish, it's enough to have dinim which are on this level, Safik Lakula. Jacob?
Perhaps a lot of d'rabbanan laws are
siyudim. Okay, very good. Right, that there seems to be, broadly speaking, and I'll say in a minute why I'm saying broadly speaking and not all the time, but broadly speaking, it's fair to say that dinim d'rabbanan are generally correlated with what we call a siyag. That generally the purpose of dinim d'rabbanan is to institute something to protect Torah law. Yes, sir.
What about
ases? Ases may also be. It's a question in general. We only have a handful of mitzvahs ases d'rabbanan, and there's a lot to discuss. Maybe we'll get to it, maybe we won't, about what is the source and the justification for mitzvahs ases d'rabbanan. And some attempt to put it in a siyag framework also. The Chanukah Purim was a siyag for Amunah. So it's an interesting question because we have to figure out what the source is for those things. But in any event, like I said, it's not absolute, and we'll discuss how it's not absolute in a minute. But roughly speaking, Drabanan correlates to the concept of the Siyach, that we have a concept of a din that's there for its own purpose. Let's say Torah law is generally there because the Kadosh Baruch Hu wants us to avoid certain things and to do other things. And usually rabbinic law is there as a safeguard to fulfill the notion of Esiyu Siyag LaTorah, Mishnah and Pirkei Avos. It's also a Gemara in Yevamos. The Gemara understands the Pasuk in Achrimos, which says, Ushmartim es Mishmarti, Asu Mishmeres Mishmarti. We should make a safeguard for Mishmeres. Mentioned this, I think it came up to you last week. You mentioned this idea, Mishmartim es Mishmarti. Now we talked about how it's surprising that there is a concept of Gzeira by Kriya Shema, because Kriya Shema is a mitzvah saseh, and Mishmartim es Mishmarti should seem to apply to low saseh. So, for the most part, Din and Rabbanan are there as protective measures. Now, emphasis on broadly, because you could come up with Din and Rabbanan that don't fit this framework. And you also possibly could come up with dinim d'oraisa that do fit this framework. And that's a separate discussion, but it could be that there are a number of dinim d'oraisa which are also protective in nature. But very broadly speaking, the Torah's rules are there for themselves, are there for their objective reasons, and Chazal's are there for protective reasons. So if that's the case, if that's a general rule, that could explain a few things. Could explain, for example, why we have a rule of Ein Gozrin Gezeira L'Gezeira. Why do we say that we don't make one Gezeira on top of another? So it could be that since every Gezeira is not really the thing itself, it's really a safeguard. So then we have a limit to how high a fence needs to be. We don't have to build a fence for a fence. We need to be able to build a fence for a thing itself. And Chazal were generally interested in protecting Torah law. They don't really have a motivation to protect their own law, to make sure that we don't violate rabbinic law. Especially because if we do violate rabbinic law, it's not inherently significant. So there, since Torah law is inherently significant, so then we understand why they want to make sure, build a fence, we shouldn't even come to violate Torah law even without full intention. But when it comes to rabbinic law is a safeguard in the first place. So if that's the case, so then it's not so crucial that there be a safeguard for that. So in the spirit of Ein Gozrin Gezeira L'Gezeira, so we also can understand Safek D'Rabbanan L'Kula. That since the law that we're talking about is, for the most part, the Gezeira, so then the Gezeira is sufficiently addressed by focusing on the Vados. Just to extend the example that we've been using. So why would the rabbi say you don't have chicken cheeseburger? So we'll say, because really, chicken cheeseburger, as far as the Torah is concerned, is not a problem at all. But beef cheeseburgers are a problem. And nowadays, we tend to associate chicken and beef for some reason. So we might think that, okay, if we know that we're allowed to have chicken cheeseburgers, we may come to also have beef cheeseburgers. Right? So okay, so the rabbi said, don't eat these chicken cheeseburgers, they will lead you to think you can have beef cheeseburgers. So it's sufficient to accomplish that purpose if we just avoid what we know is a chicken cheeseburger. If you have something which has something mixed in it and you don't know, and someone tells you, no, I don't know, there might be some chicken cheeseburger mixed in there, it's a suffix. So you could argue it's not necessary to avoid that. It's only that when you know you're eating a chicken cheeseburger, we're worried that that will lead you to eating a beef cheeseburger. But if you don't even know you're eating a chicken cheeseburger in the first place, So the whole concept is really a siag. So the siag is sufficient when you actually know it. Just to give another example for your question, we know we have a concept, say, bishul akum. Right? Bishul akum is there to keep you from intermarriage, at least according to one possibility. So we could say, all right, really the Torah doesn't have a problem with eating this item, but when you're happily eating this item that was cooked by a non-Jew, you might decide to marry his daughter. But if you don't even know that that's what it is, you're not sure that what you're eating is bishul akum, so then you could say, why should this lead you to intermarriage when you don't even know that you're dealing with this step in the first place? So there's no reason to be machmir when you don't know that you're dealing with this issue. So if we're coming from this perspective, that it's a siag, so then we could understand perhaps why there's no point in being machmir on a suffix, and therefore that could be reason number two, why kach tiknu, because it was sufficient for their purposes just to deal with definite known situations, and there's no need to extend anything more than necessary to extend to, oh, even if you don't know, but it might be, that's also something to worry about. Yisrael.
Was the concept of mango 3.0 only was that only a concept created for this instance, or was that a concept used for something else?
So that's a good question. The history of that is a little bit subject to analysis, so it's an interesting question, because you could ask, is it limited to dinim d'rabbanan, or theoretically does it have a role in dinim d'raisa, which is a fascinating topic. Get me started on that, I'll happily talk to you about it all day, but then we're never going to finish this topic. So if you want, I'm happy to find the time to come back to that topic, but it'll take us a little bit far afield. So that's a different reason why we could say that it made sense. Safek d'rabbanan l'kula, it's consistent with its purpose, and that's how Chazal set things up. Okay? So what should we call this? I don't know. The nature of siyag. Right? The fact that we're dealing with the siyag, that's enough. Now, the logic that we just saw here, this could also be consistent with another approach. You guys see the Meshul Chachma today? Is on today's list?
Yep.
I forgot to ask which people finished list. They didn't finish list? Pretty much. Okay, so you saw the Meshul Chachma. So Meshul Chachma represents another approach, but it's one that has a lot in common with what we just said. And he gives a mashal of a king and a prince. But here we're students in the school, so let's give the mashal, let's change it a little bit. Let's give a mashal of a principal and a teacher. It's a little closer to our world. Okay, so you have a school. So the principal hires the teachers. And the principal is the ultimate authority, let's pretend the board doesn't exist for a second. The principal is the ultimate authority in the school. So therefore, the authority rests within him. And when he hires a teacher, so he gives that teacher authority. So he tells the students, he comes into class on the first day, he says, this teacher is given authority by me, so you better listen to him. And so the authority for the teacher comes from the principal. But that doesn't mean that everything the principal says and the teacher says are identical. When the teacher talks, it's not the principal talking. We all understand the difference. And we understand that there's a hierarchy too. And we know that the teacher is not on the same level as the principal. It's just that the teacher is backed up by the principal. So if you decide to punch a teacher in the face, don't do that, by the way, but if you decide to punch a teacher in the face, so you know you're going to have to answer to the principal. And you know that the principal is going to ultimately be the authority that will deal with you. But we don't confuse the teacher and the principal. We understand that they're different. So according to this approach, that's what lo sasa means. But that lo sasa means that the Torah backs up the authority of Chazal, of the rabbis. The rabbis have authority because the Torah says so. But it doesn't mean that everything the rabbis say is the same thing as if the Torah says it. We understand the difference. So it's no contradiction to say that everything is located in Lo Sasser, while at the same time saying there are different rules. To say Suffolk Lakula here doesn't contradict the idea that it all emanates from Lo Sasser. Lo Sasser doesn't mean that every violation of rabbinic law is going to be a violation of Lo Sasser in the same sense that eating chazer is a violation of a law in the Torah. It means that Lo Sasser is the backup, is the backing for all of the commands of Chazal.
Is that only because
not necessarily, because it means that there's inherently a difference. We understand that just like there's inherently a difference, the teacher is not telling you taking less seriously than the principal. We understand that the principal and the teacher are different, and that the extent when the principal comes in and says, you better listen to the teacher, he doesn't mean that when the teacher says, okay, everyone open up to page 56, that it's now as if the principal is saying, open up to page 56. It's the teacher telling you to do this. But we understand that the reason I'm not going to mess with the teacher, the reason the teacher has authority over me, is because ultimately he has the principal's backing. And if I were to say to the teacher, sorry, I don't have to listen to you, the principal is going to call me into his office and say, yes, you do.
That creates a distinction.
It's inherently different. It means that there's no hechrich to say that it was l'chumra in the first place. The only reason to say, oh, doesn't it have to be l'chumra, like the Ramban is asking, is because how could you escape the fact that you're violating an issur d'oraisa every time you don't fulfill a din d'rabbanan? So the answer to that is like, no, it's not true that you're violating a din d'rabbanan, a din d'oraisa, or time to violate a din d'rabbanan. You're violating a din d'oraisa, and this is how some svarim explicitly understand it. If you were to say, the rabbis have no authority over me, they can't tell me what to do, that would be a violation of the din d'oraisa, a violation of Lo Sasser. So if somebody were to eat the chicken cheeseburger, because they say, you know, sometimes people certainly do, if somebody would say, listen, I don't hold from this whole thing, I'm a Torah Jew, I'm not a rabbinic Jew, so if the rabbis tell me I can't eat chicken cheeseburger, well, that's very nice, because they haven't tried it, they don't know how good it is, I'm not going to listen to them. So then, that, if I don't have authority over me, then they can't tell me what to do, that would be a violation of Lo Sasser. But if one says, listen, I recognize rabbinic authority, but I am starving and it looks so good and they have such an attractive offer on the sign in the bird king, so then that, according to some, would not be a violation of Lo Sasser. Lo Sasser would only happen if one rejects rabbinic authority as rabbinic authority, but not simply because you violate the din d'rabbanan. And we could understand that by saying that we know that we don't really think that the Torah told us to not eat chicken and cheeseburgers. We think the Torah told us to listen to the rabbis, and this is one of the things that they said to do.
Last follow-up.
By the way, just also as a little bit of another thing that I mentioned, that after when we eventually finish talking about Chazal, then Din D'Rabbanan, that our next sugya was going to be Chinuch. So Chinuch, which itself is mostly Din D'Rabbanan, also largely rests on understanding some of these mechanics. So this is also a hakdamah to the next sugya. So just remember some of the principles that we're seeing here, because they're all going to resurface when we talk about the chinuch concept, because it also draws heavily on some of what we're saying. A lot of overlapping introductions. So yes, continue.
So you know what
we
said about that can be the case, but then why is the Meshach HaKadosh to explain why if it has to be under Rabban said you can make it here?
Because it doesn't mean that they're telling you assertively Lakula. The point is that the question doesn't have to be so compelling. That we don't have to say that, oh, but you're violating Torah law, Suffolk Teraisa Lachum, it's the same thing. It's not the same thing. The authority, broadly speaking, comes from the Torah. But the specifics, and this seems to be what the Rambam is getting at. Part of the proof, you saw the Rambam in Hilchos Brachos, right, that there is a difference, but there are some who are on the other side of the Rambam, from the Ramban. There are some who are more extreme than the Rambam is in identifying rabbinic law with Torah law. Because one of the points the Rambam makes in Sefer HaMitzvos, the Rambam has to figure out, how am I going to count 613 mitzvos? The Gemara says in Makos there are 613 commandments given in Sinai, so we have to figure out for some reason how do you get that. So the Rishonim, some of them struggled with this question. I don't know why, by the way, historically, it worked out that way, that it's only during the time of the Rishonim. That before the Rishonim and after the Rishonim, no one took up this question of how do you count the 613 mitzvahs. But there are a number of prominent Rishonim, the Rambam maybe the most prominently among them, you know, the Smag and others, who took up the task of counting mitzvahs. I guess the Achronim assumed already just they took up the task of commenting on the earlier and what the Rishonim wrote about this. But it's an interesting question what the Nafkamina is. But whatever it is, so the Rambam says that when I count mitzvos, I'm not going to count mitzvos that are Drabbanan. Because I'm not going to come and tell you that, oh, because of Los Osir, therefore every mitzvah that the Rabbanan innovate, that has a status of a Din Daraisa. No, it's a Din Drabbanan. And to say that that's part of the 613 mitzvah Shenemru B'Sinai, that much I can't say. But there were Rishonim who did say that, who did count mitzvahs Drabbanan as mitzvahs Daraisa. But the Rambam doesn't mean that. The Rambam is saying, like the teacher and the principal, like the king and the prince, that the mitzvah Daraisa is Lo Sasser, and whatever flows from that is not necessarily itself a mitzvah min HaTorah. So you saw in Hilchos Brachos, the Rambam comments, the Gemara in the Chanukah Sugyas, in Maseches Shabbos, the Gemara raises the question, on Chanukah, it's our next Yontif up on the horizon, so we're going to recite a bracha every night. We're going to say, Asher Kishona B'mitzvosav, V'tzivonu V'hadlik Ner Shal Chanukah. So the Gemara asks, really? I read the whole Chumash, I don't see anywhere that it told us to light Chanukah candles. Sehechon Sivonu asks the Gemara, where do you see that there is such a thing? So according to the first opinion, the Gemara of Nachman, which seems like a big support for the Rambam, the idea is Leisaser. So this is one of the Gemaras that seems like it's basically saying what the Rambam says, except that the Gemara has two opinions there, Nachman and Revivia. Revivia's opinion that it's from Hazinu, from Shalavicha V'Yageicha, that's not really a full endorsement of the Ramban, but it's different. The other Gemara, by the way, you saw today, the Gemara in Brachos, which brought us a riot for both sides, parenthetically, because the Gemara there in Daf Yutes in Brachos, the Gemara says that there was a statement that even though we normally say Kavod HaBrios does not, our human dignity does not outweigh Torah law, then the Gemara has a statement that is Docha Lo Sase Shuvah Torah, that it pushes off Torah law. So the Gemara says, what do you mean? You can't do that. And then the Gemara goes on to suggest that we're talking about one specific Torah law, losasim and adavar. So the Gemara goes on to explain that kol milsa drabanan asmochuhu alav losasir. All of the din drabanan are associated with losasir. So that also seems to be a good proof for the Rambam. Except the Ramban brings that as a proof for him, because he says the Gemara is telling you asmachuhu means asmach, that they hung it on Lo Sasser, but not that it's actually what Lo Sasser is telling you. So that Gemara is debatable. But here, this Gemara in Shabbos says, because Lo Sasser, we say, Asher Kirishana Mizvosa V'sivana L'hadak Ner Shulchanikin. But the Rambam explains in Hilchos Brachos, what do we mean when we say those words? We mean Asher Kedushanu b'mitzvosa v'tzivanu. Right, you saw this. L'shmoa el elu shetzivanu lahadik ner shal Chanukah. That we were commanded to listen to those who told us to light Chanukah candles. And in fact, the Yerushalmi has a gerusha. I didn't put this on the list. I can give it to you to look at tomorrow. That maybe the bracha should actually be for dinim drabanan al mitzvah zekanim. The mitzvah to listen to Zakenim. So we're not necessarily saying it creates its own din as if it's a din min HaTorah, that we believe that God commanded us to light Chanukah candles. No, we believe that God commanded us to listen to the rabbis. And the rabbis said, light Chanukah candles. Okay, so this... Hi.
By Shofar, why do we say that according to that explanation?
Well, by shofar is a mitzvah deraisa.
Right.
So we use it by a lot of deraisas also. So it means either, apparently it could mean both. That either means the shekhar shofar to solve this mitzvah, shofar, lulav, whatever it is, or the broader formulation of l'shmoa l'elu shetzivani, that apparently it includes both. But in the context of Chanukah candles, it doesn't mean this was directly from the Torah, it means that this is something that emanates from the fact that we listen to the rabbis. So it seems very credible that that's also, all of these explanations really seem very compatible with Rambam's idea that, yes, Lo Sasser is where it comes from, but that doesn't mean that there is a din d'oraisa status that goes with these din. Okay, so far so good? Okay, so this has implications because there is a approach which is compatible with most of what we just said just now. This whole king, prince, principal, teacher, mashal, and also the siag kach tiknu idea, all share a certain possible approach. There is a view in Achronim, it's a prominent view, that draws a distinction between dinim d'oraisa and dinim d'rabbanan in their very nature. And it suggests, again this is compatible with both of the previous two points, that a din d'oraisa could be inherent in the object. If you have something that's asur min haTorah, let's say, you have chazer that's prohibited min haTorah. So that could mean that the chazer has an inherent status to it. What we call, in brisker terms, chepza shel iser. The iser is inherent in the item. God made the world, God wrote the Torah, God said chazer is tameh. There is inherent tumah in the object. Inherent iser in the object. When you're dealing with a din d'rabbanan, one could argue that there's no such thing. Chicken cheeseburger, before Chazal came and prohibited it, that was neutral. Right? When it was mutter, it was neutral. It wasn't good or bad. So Chazal came and prohibited it. So now we're not allowed to eat it. Does that mean that it now becomes an Isra Chavza? It was neutral before, and now it's all of a sudden inherently different. So a number of prominent Achronim believe that no, that doesn't make sense. That there's a fundamental difference. A din min haTorah, that can be usur b'chefza, that can have something that is in the object. But when the rabbis come and make a law, they can't change the world. What stops us from eating a chicken cheeseburger? Chicken cheeseburger is inherently spiritually damaging? No, what stops us from eating a chicken cheeseburger is leisasum and adavra shegid l'chadu. When the rabbis tell you that I want you to eat a chicken cheeseburger, we are obligated to listen to the rabbis. So as Jewish people who follow the Torah, we have to listen to the rabbis, so therefore we're not allowed to eat chicken cheeseburger. So that you would call, in brisker terminology, what? An iser gavra. The person, the individual, is instructed that he cannot eat chicken cheeseburgers. But the chicken cheeseburger didn't change identity. It can't. There's no svara that it should. All that happened was you received a prohibition to eat it. So that's an iser on you as a gavra. All Jewish adults are instructed to listen to the Torah that they're not allowed to do this. But its essence did not change. Its essence is still neutral. So there are many who make this distinction that when it comes to Torah law, you could have theoretically an Isser Chefza. And when it comes to rabbinic law, it doesn't make sense. It's by its very nature an Isser Gavra. The item is neutral, and you are told stay away from it. So far, so good? Okay, this view, which is a popular view in Achronim, is often associated with the position of the Nesiva Samishbat. So the Nesiva is the last thing on today's Makoros. Maybe you'll see it tomorrow. It's in Choshen Mishbat and Reish Lamed Daled. That there, and you'll see, if you look inside, you'll see the context is explaining a certain din in Shulchan Aruch over there in Choshen Mishbat. The Nesiva seems to say the following. I say seems to say because it's subject to a lot of interpretation in the later Sfarim, but we'll deal with it as he's generally taken. The Nesiva seems to be saying the following. We know that we have a concept that if I do an Avera, I'm subject to an Onesh sometimes. Some Averas from the Torah come with punishments. Sometimes there's a distinction. If I do an Avera b'mezid, so there's an Onesh. If I do it on purpose, there's an Onesh. If I do it b'shogeg, if I do it inadvertently, so then it doesn't make sense that there's an Onesh. But we sometimes find there is a kapara associated. There's something we have to do to atone. Why do we have to atone? It wasn't intentional. Didn't have Aver b'shogeg. Why is there an atonement? Because you still encountered a spiritual stain. You didn't do it on purpose, but you still did something that was spiritually damaging, so it needs to be fixed. Implies the Nesivis, but this only makes sense when you're dealing with Torah law. When you're dealing with rabbinic law, if you violate something b'shogeg, there is no need for a kapara. What do you think he means by that? This is the way the Achronim have read it. What do you think he's saying? Why is there such a distinction?
This is whether you did something which should be wrong to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you have to fix it, or if you just see out.
Okay, so basically that's what I was saying. This is consistent with a lot of the different things we're saying. They all revolve around the same point and lead you to the same conclusion. That one, you could say, that by the very nature of things, Torah law could be inherent. And therefore, if you violate Torah law, even if it wasn't on purpose, you still ate something poisonous, so to speak. And you still need to go to the doctor. If you ate poison by accident, you're still going to need to take care of it. But when it comes to rabbinic law, so these points all flow from one another, there's nothing inherent. There's no actual spiritual damage that it causes. It's an Isser Gavra. And the nature of the Isser Gavra is a compatible yet different point. Right? The nature of the Isser Gavra is broader. Right? You're not supposed to rebel against rabbinic authority. You're not supposed to say, I don't think they can tell me what to do. That's what's known as some of the Sachronim phrases say that all of Isurim Drabanan are a Isser Mered. What does that mean? It's an Isser to rebel. You're not allowed to rebel against Chazal. That's what we're always talking about. If you're going to decide, I can eat chicken cheeseburgers, no one can tell me not to. So that's an act of rebellion against Chazal. It's not a specific Torah violation of eating chicken cheeseburgers. There's no such thing. It's a violation of Lo Sasser, which means do not rebel against Chazal. So therefore, what flows from that? That if you did it for Shogeg, you didn't know you were doing it. So there's no rebellion. So again, it's a different, it's a subtly different but compatible point. There's no need for a kapara, A, because there's nothing, there's no spiritual stain, b'shogeg, there's nothing in the object, and you didn't do anything wrong, because the whole nature of the Isser is to rebel against Chazal, and you didn't rebel.
Sure.
It was an accident. Yisrael had said that first, sorry.
So Magos Martis is only because...
intentional rebellion.
So it's not because you violated some sort of Isser, meaning...
Yes, because you rebelled against Chazal. The act of a person who's insisting he's going to ignore rabbinic law.
So,
right,
so
that represents the whole idea.
You're not punished for eating the cheeseburger, the chicken cheeseburger, you're punished because you rebelled.
That's actually what the phrase conveys. It highlights that point, that the makas that would be associated with Din D'Rabbanan is not because of this terrible issue of eating a chicken cheeseburger. It's because of the rebellion. Because you rebelled against Chazal, that's the issue. So that, again, ties together a lot of points work here. So another, just to also explain, you say, Safek Drabbanan Lakula, because it's not so terrible if you're not sure if it's an Isser Drabbanan. So then you have the right to be Mekel, because the whole nature of Torah law on the one hand is there's some inherent issue here. So we certainly shouldn't violate it on purpose, but maybe even we have to be careful, Derabbanan. We have to be careful rather to shove the safek, because there's something here, there's something in it. But when it comes to rabbinic law, the whole point is to be compliant. So if I'm being compliant, there's no chance that there's anything more to worry about. I know I'm following the rabbinic law, that is the whole story. So therefore, it's safe to say safek derabbanan lekula, because as long as I know I'm compliant, that's enough. So this is a popular approach many achronim take. Just to illustrate it with one more example, there's a Tosus in Yevamos that says that we know, let's say if a Kohen finds himself in a house with a dead body, it's Tuma Daraisa. So the Kohen has to run out of the building. He can't be there together with the Tuma Daraisa. So the Tosus that says, if it's a Tuma Darabanan, then the Kohen also has to leave. But he doesn't have to run, he can walk. So what does that mean? It means we'll measure it, we'll give him a speedometer, because Torah law is more serious, so you have to run fast. But rabbinic law, we're more laid back, so you can walk slower. What does that mean? Yeah, Jacob?
Well, we were explaining. Torah law is inherently bad, so for you to get out as quickly as possible.
Excellent.
There are bottom, it's only about
compliance.
Rebelling, being merit, and as long as you're walking out, as long as you're leaving, you're not rebelling against
it. Excellent. That's how Bochanan Wasserman explains the distinction, that if Torah law is inherent, so then it's dangerous, you got to leave. But when it comes to rabbinic law, it's about compliance. If you're leaving, you're compliant. It doesn't matter how fast you're compliant. So this, you could draw the parallel. It's like the difference between a fire and a fire drill. If there was a fire in the building, God forbid, everyone's going to run as quick as they can, because they know the fire is dangerous and they don't want to get touched by the fire. If there's a fire drill and everyone knows a fire drill, then they tend to walk, not run, because they're not actually afraid of anything happening. They just know they have to comply. The law is they have to cooperate. They have to comply with the fire drill. So they leave. They don't leave quickly. They just comply. They don't have a need to run. That's essentially the distinction that this Tosus is suggesting. Torah law, it's like a fire, it's something real. While the rabbinic law is about compliance, so if you're complying, that's the beginning and end of it. So this, again, is an approach many achronim have. One notable outlier in the opposite camp is Hagayin HaGadol of Yosef Engel. How many times have we mentioned him this year so far? Not so many, I guess. But last year, certainly talk about this. So Yosef Engel was a great Talmudist from Poland, lived in the early 1900s, was a tremendous Eloi, the author of many, many Svarim. So one of his many important Svarim is a Sefer called Asfan Daraisa. And in the Asfan Daraisa, he explains that he takes issue with this whole approach. He doesn't think it's correct. The idea that rabbinic law is always an Isser Gavra, is always addressed to the individual, and Torah law, that could be inherent, but rabbinic law cannot be, it doesn't accept it. And other things it doesn't accept there also, it's a Kedai essay to read. But one of the points that he makes is that he thinks the whole distinction isn't true. This is based on a Gemara Nechulin, which I could give you to look at tomorrow, where the Gemara essentially suggests that when the rabbis make an enactment, HaKadosh Baruch Hu signs off on it. God endorses it. So even though, yes, yesterday the chicken cheeseburger was neutral, and today why should that change? It changes because HaKadosh Baruch Hu endorses what the rabbis do. So when the rabbis come and say chicken cheeseburgers overrated, yes, the world changes because HaKadosh Baruch Hu signs off on it. So he does not accept this whole distinction, and says Dinan Drabanan can also be inherently Isser, inherently Usser as well. So maybe it's Shinikapar, but he doesn't have to agree with the Nesivis. He doesn't have to agree with a lot of these distinctions. But it's a chiddush and nesivus that there's no such concept as a kapara. Now, not every daraisa needs a kapara. There's a lot to figure out when you say and when you don't. And there's a lot of sub discussion about the nesivus. The nesivus saying there's no need for tshuva, or just no need for a kapara. There's a lot to try to figure out. But essentially, this is a machlokas between the nesivus camp, as built upon by later svarim, such as the Meshech Chachma, the Meshech Chachma that you saw today, and also the Meshech Chachma and Sefer in the Rambam, which is called Or Sameach, right? The Or Sameach, he has a similar approach there, L'shitaso. So the Or Sameach, the Nesivus, and many others in one camp, and Rav Yosef Engel in the other camp, that there could be an Issur Rabbanan B'chepza, there could be other associations, because the rabbis have an enactment, God signs off on it, God endorses it. So this is a major machlokes. So what seems to me very clear is that this is the question we were talking about all last week. And so when the rabbis say, don't take a shofar, don't blow a shofar on Shabbos, don't take a lulav on Shabbos, or sit in the sukkah a certain way, or maybe even make kiddush a certain way, or bench a certain way, so we've been asking, is it possible to be? Could it be like Tosfos and our Daf and Daf Gimel says, that if you violate the Din D'Rabbanan, the mitzvah, the raisa of Sukkah isn't even fulfilled at all? Could it be? So according to the Ran, no, it can't be. The Torah is still Chai V'Kayim. If it says it's good, then rabbinic law doesn't change that. And Tosfos said, no, it does change. And we saw that Vinny Yonah has this idea that Kriya Shema is going to become limited in a fundamental way. We saw the whole back and forth with Akiva Eger and the Kav and the Kashesa. And we saw all these back and forths. Could it be that rabbinic law can rewrite the Torah and make a mitzvah no longer exist? So it seems clear it's these two tzadim. That if one follows the approach of the Nesivus and the Or Sameach and that whole camp, then no, it can't be. Rabbinic authority is limited to Jewish people. Jewish people have to listen to what the rabbis say because they are bound to the mitzvah of Los Asr. The mitzvah of the Torah of Los Asr told Jewish people they have to listen to the rabbis. So therefore, they're not allowed to eat chicken cheeseburgers. And they're not allowed to blow shofar on Shabbos. But the mitzvah of shofar on Shabbos is still there, because why does the Torah have to change because the rabbis said don't do it? The Torah will always be what it is. But the mitzvah of Los Asr, which tells Jewish people what to do, is so powerful it can even tell them don't blow shofar on Shabbos. And to ignore the continuing presence of the Torah mitzvah. But according to Rav Yosef Engel, say no, you can rewrite the Torah because HaKadosh Baruch Hu endorses what the rabbis do. So just like HaKadosh Baruch Hu will come and say that the chicken cheeseburger now is bad inherently because he endorses the rabbinic initiative, so too he will also say, you know what, there's no longer a mitzvah to blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah when that day is also Shabbos. So it seems pretty clear, it's not a shkafta v'ferach, that this machlokas, these are the two tzadim that we've been talking about, the machlokas between the Nesivus and his whole camp, and Rav Yosef Engel, this is the machlokas Tosfos and the Ran. This is the machlokas Rabbi Akiva Eger and the Kav and Kashetzer. These are the same two possibilities. It all revolves around this question, does rabbinic law simply mean you can't rebel against the rabbis, but it's just about you and how you relate to rabbinic authority? Or is there more to it? Does the Kodesh Baruch Hu endorse it to such an extent that reality now changes, the mitzvahs of the Torah now change, everything goes along with that impact? Now, this attitude, I think, affects a number of other issues. So we'll have to, I think it explains a number of other things about our attitude to rabbinic law. So I guess we'll have to comment on that tomorrow. So All right, so we're up to daven now. So maybe just to very quickly recap. So we spoke about, we'll daven in a second. Spoke about the machlokas, the Rambam and the Ramban. We talked about the Ramban's question of how could it be that rabbinic law all comes from Los Osir, why does that not obligate us to be machmir b'safek? And we saw there are a couple ways to explain, even within the view of the Rambam, either you could say that they purposely set it up that way in order to avoid baltosis, and step that at length, or they set it up that way because it's all that was necessary, since their dinim are essentially safeguards and not necessarily something that is inherent. And that's consistent, although different than the next approach, that we could use a mashal of, like the Meshach HaFimah does, a king and a prince, like we adapted it to a principal and a teacher, that we understand that when there's a greater authority that backs up a more localized authority, it means that ultimately if you rebel against the local authority, you're going to have to answer it to the higher authority, but it doesn't mean that we confuse the two. We still understand that the higher authority is different than the lower authority. And so too, when it comes to rabbinic law, it's the same thing. And then we discussed how this could yield an understanding that's all about an isser of rebellion. And it's all about rebellion, that means that there's nothing inherent. This is consistent with the view of the Nesivos HaMishpat as understood by later Svarim, that there's no need for a kapara, for Nisid Rabbanan B'Shogeh, because you're not rebelling. And that leads to this whole view that there's no Isra Cheftza by Yedin Rabbanan. It's all between you and your submission to rabbinic authority. And there will therefore be that difference on many levels between Deraisa and the Rabbanan laws. But Rav Yosef Engel disagreed. Rav Yosef Engel said that no, there is inherent nature to rabbinic law because the Kadosh Baruch Hu signs off on it, and therefore that makes things different. And this essentially seems to be the question we've been talking about. Do we say that once Chazal make a rule that top of Torah law, that redefines things or not, Tosfos and the Ran and everything that came after that seems to be essentially this machlokas. So we'll see some additional ramifications of this, God willing, tomorrow. Now, by rabbinic law, we have Dav Mincha, so who's volunteering?